Today's program has been brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. Made with a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. For more information, visit www.rt11.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, Executive Vice President of the James Beard Foundation, and every week at 11 o'clock on Wednesdays, we have a conversation that I hope you find as interesting as I do about my favorite subject, that is taste. And today, we are very excited to have with us in the studio someone who has tapped into an undercurrent, let's say, a growing, we could say, in quotes, movement that has tremendous implications for taste and so many other things, and that is the fermentation movement. And I'm sitting here with Sander Katz, who is the author of The Art of Fermentation and who describes himself as a fermentation revivalist, and it's such a pleasure to have you with us here in the studio, Sander.
Thanks so much for having me on the show, Mitchell.
So let's talk about this funny, smelly, messy subject of fermentation, the art of fermentation, if you will. First of all, I suppose we should explain what it is. Let's go to biology, 11th grade, or I don't know when it starts these days in the curriculum. What are we talking about?
Well, broadly speaking, fermentation is the transformative action of microorganisms. What the definition of fermentation that biologists use is more specific than that, and that would be the production of energy without oxygen, anaerobic metabolism. And in that sense, the cells of our bodies are capable of fermentation, and fermentation, is a widespread natural phenomenon. And most of the classic fermented foods and beverages are, fit this scientific definition. They're anaerobic, the production of wine from grapes, of beer from barley, of yogurt from milk, of sauerkraut from cabbages. These are all anaerobic, but there are a few fermented foods and beverages that require oxygen, and everybody regards them as fermented as well. So some examples of this would be vinegar, kombucha, tempeh, molded cheeses. So I just prefer to work with a broader lay definition that fermentation is the transformative action of microorganisms, but with one other specific caveat, and which is that, all of the food that we discard, the food that we would regard as spoiled or rotten, it's spoiled or rotten because of the transformative action of microorganisms. So generally, we reserve this word fermentation to describe intentional or desirable microbial transformations rather than the undesirable ones.
Of course, there are implications of this transformation on taste that some people would be, ew, that's gross, it tastes rotten. Are there not?
Well,
even if it's intentional.
I mean, I think conceptually to people, of our, historical period, they can respond that way in the abstract. But once you start talking about specific foods, I mean, really all of the most celebrated delicacies from culinary traditions all around the world are products of fermentation. And if you walk into any kind of a gourmet food store and look around and think about the nature of the foods that we elevate on this pedestal, they're almost all products of fermentation. Cheeses, cured meats, chocolate. Chocolate, coffee, all of the condiments that we love to put on our foods either are directly fermented or else they use vinegar, a product of fermentation, in order to stabilize them. So, fermentation creates these flavors that are compelling. They're not necessarily universally beloved, but once you acquire a taste for them, people tend to, have very strong, sort of attachments to them.
And those flavors, we're actually going to jump ahead to something I wanted to talk about later, but since we're already there, those flavors are complex in ways that sort of simple, fresh, unfermented flavors are not. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a sort of a complexity, a layering of flavors that comes with fermentation, and that's really ultimately what makes them so compelling.
Hmm. Now, I'm going to throw this out there again, unexpectedly, but I once wrote a paper that the rise in the popularity of the flavor umami, which people describe as deliciousness, or it's a Japanese term that's become the fifth taste. In my lifetime, you never thought that you would add a taste to the sort of wheel that you learn in the fourth grade. But is actually related to this process of fermentation, and in some ways could be characterized as the taste of time. Like these things that you just described, there is an element of time that adds to their value as well as to their complexity of flavor. Could you talk about the role of time in fermentation?
Well, sure. Taking a historical look and trying to, I mean, first of all, we don't know the origins of almost any fermented foods because they all are so ancient that they're prehistoric, and we don't have any, you know, sort of specific documentation of their emergence. But, you know, they arose out of practical necessity. I mean, basically, you know, in order for people to be able to sort of move from hunter-gatherer lifestyles to settled agricultural societies, you know, that is only possible if you have some insight into how to effectively preserve food. I mean, you can't invest all of your energy into crops that are ready at a certain moment of the year unless you have some effective strategies for preserving those to get you through the rest of the year. So, you know, really, most fermentation processes are born out of necessity. You know, you take something that's very perishable and turn it into something that is much more stable. So I would say that that's sort of, you know, the first way in which time relates to fermentation. But you know, because fermentations are created, you know, over time, and we're working with microorganisms, and generally it's communities of microorganisms, and you see an evolution of these communities over the period of the fermentation. So the flavor complexity, sort of grows as a result of the successional processes. In other words, you get the metabolic byproducts of a series of different specific microbial strains. And, you know, that's what really gives these long-aged foods the incredible flavor complexity that they have.
Mm. So the way you've described the processes and the actual transformation that happens is quite scientific, and yet you're right about the art of fermentation. Could you perhaps explain why it's an art and why it isn't a science? I mean, although obviously science...
Well, I mean, I would say it's an art and a science. And you know, certainly science has given us the tools to understand what is happening as we practice the arts of fermentation. So, you know, for instance, you know, the fermentation of alcoholic beverages. You know, we know that this has been practiced for, you know, at least 9,000 years because there are pottery shards that have been dated to 9,000 years with residue of alcohol. Alcohol. And so, you know, 9,000 years ago in a, you know, Neolithic settlement in China, you know, they couldn't see Saccharomyces cerevisiae. You know, they did not have a clear understanding of, you know, what was the microorganism that was making this happen. You know, and yet they learned a lot about how to manipulate environmental conditions in order to sort of get the results that they wanted. And so all around the world, you know, through trial and error, through the, you know, human powers of observation, you know, through, you know, language and our tools for passing information down from generation to generation, you know, people learned how to, I mean, really what it amounts to is manipulate environmental conditions in order to encourage the growth of certain organisms and simultaneously discourage the growth of other organisms. And so without a microscope, without the ability to identify these organisms, you know, people learned how to sort of, you know, guide them and direct the process. But it really was an art and not a science. And it's only really in the last 150 years since Louis Pasteur did his groundbreaking work that anyone has been able to sort of approach these processes in a scientific way. And we have learned a lot. But I mean, my position would be that, you know, the efforts of microbiology to improve upon these processes, you know, have been very, very mixed and, you know, not altogether successful and really, you know, working with the, you know, wild organisms that are spontaneously on the food itself, we actually can have, you know, much better results than we can, you know, working with organisms that have been isolated in a laboratory that are commercially available today.
We're going to get back to that topic, I think, but I want to remind people listening, it's obvious that Sander is an expert and deserves the the role that he has. And I'm not sure anyone has thought about both the art and the science of fermentation in such gastronomic terms as he. And you, if you have questions for him about that process, call us at 718-497-2128. You can also email us at info@heritageradionetwork.org, even if you're listening to the podcast or to the archive on heritageradionetwork.org. Or you can tweet us at Taste Matters, HRN. So this question of science, I was shocked recently to learn from an eminent scientist at the Rainforest Alliance that actually genetically modified organisms have been used in fermentation processes to try to isolate certain flavors or to produce a certain effect in a finished wine or something like that. That at a level of GMO, you know, we think of corn and soybeans and sometimes a fish. I'm sure you have a thought about that, and whether or not that's a successful endeavor or a desirable endeavor. But could you just comment?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that microorganisms. I mean, there's more genetic modification happening of microorganisms than there is of macroorganisms.
Right.
And specifically in industrial food production, in the production of enzymes, you know, which don't get listed on ingredients. But there are a lot of bacteria and fungi that have been genetically engineered in order to produce specific enzymes, and yeasts have been genetically engineered. I don't know. I mean, I have no experience with this. I mean, I don't have a clear idea of what the sort of supposed advantages of these. I mean, I would say, you know, a step removed from genetic engineering, the breeding of these organisms, which are arguably people have been doing since before we could identify the organisms, sort of simply through the process of selection. But I would say that in the laboratory age, our ability to sort of isolate microorganisms. I mean, I have to assume that for mass producers, there are certain advantages to this. But I would say, to this day, the highest quality wines are the wines that are made with the organisms that are naturally found on the grapes. The highest quality beers are the wild yeasted beers, primarily associated with Belgium, but really made in many different parts of the world, including increasingly in the United States. The finest cheeses are the raw milk cheeses that depend upon the organisms that are, naturally present in the milk and in the aging environment. And the best cured meats are the meats that are made, sort of using the organisms spontaneously found on the meat rather than introduced with a starter. So starter cultures can make things easier. They can make for more predictable or consistent results. But, still, I think that there's widespread agreement, among connoisseurs that the best flavors come from the, organisms that are wild, that are spontaneously present on these foods. And that's certainly the origin of all of the fermentation processes, is just the fact that these organisms are inevitably present on our food and we can work with them.
Okay. How did you get into this? How did you become a James Beard nominated author of a book on fermentation from your beginnings on the Upper West Side, let's say?
Well, I always loved sour pickles.
And, there you go. Careful, watch it, kids.
I mean, as a kid, once I started having a little bit of independence in the city, sour pickles were just my sort of cheap snack of choice, and I've just always been drawn to that flavor. But it's not like my grandmother was making her own pickles, or anyone in my family was really fermenting anything. What got me trying fermentation out? I mean, I've always loved the idea of cooking things from scratch and figuring out how things are made. Mm-hmm. And, that's always been a compelling idea for me that, all these things have origins just as products of agriculture and the sort of magical alchemy of sort of, turning them into the foods that you love to eat. But about 20 years ago, I moved from New York City to rural Tennessee and started keeping a garden for the first time in my life. And I was such a naive city kid that it had never occurred to me that all of the cabbage would be ready at the same time. So, so when I was faced with with this opportunity of this row of cabbage and what are we going to do with it, I recalled how much I loved sauerkraut, and I literally looked in the Joy of Cooking, the '60s edition of the Joy of Cooking had a nice sauerkraut recipe, and I learned how to make sauerkraut from the Joy of Cooking, and then that sort of led me into a little bit of an obsession, and I started just investigating how to ferment everything I could learn about and trying it out.
And we are grateful that you did. We're going to take a brief break. We'll be right back with Sander Katz, author of The Art of Fermentation. You're listening to Taste Matters.
You're listening to Knife Show's remix of All Right, OK by Tennille on heritageradionetwork.org. Following program has been brought to you by Root 11 Potato Chips. From the moment Root 11 Potato Chips dropped their first batch of chips back in the early days of 1992, they understood their destiny as a high-quality producer. Instead of succumbing to the frenzy of mass production, they took advantage of their small size and made chipping a personal art form. The payoff was immediate, an incredible potato chip. With a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. In this world of uncertainty that we live in, Root 11 Potato Chips believes comfort food should be just that. Know where your food comes from. For more information, visit rt11.com.
Welcome back to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, and I'm talking with Sander Katz, the self-proclaimed fermentation revivalist. Let's talk about that revivalism of fermentation. A couple of weeks ago, in anticipation of your arrival here, I attended the Ferment 2013 festival in Brooklyn. An email goes out a few months in advance, and people in all parts of Bushwick and Williamsburg and Greenpoint and probably Canarsie and everywhere in between start fermenting things that they can bring and share. And there must have been 100 people there and workshops. And what do you think this whole thing is tapping onto? One of our listeners has asked this question too. What's in this revival?
Well, I mean, there's nothing new about fermented foods. Everybody eats fermented foods every day, and this was as true when I was growing up in the 70s as it is today. What's different is that, there is a broader movement of people, who are trying to reclaim their food in general, who, sort of see the downside of, centralized mass production of food, centralized agriculture. The rise of farmers markets, and sort of associated with this, the interest in knowing where our food comes from is just a growing interest in, all of the basic, processes to transform food, not only fermentation, but canning and, just all all forms of, you know, how people make use of the products of agriculture. So I sort of see the renewed interest in fermentation as a manifestation of a broader interest in where our food comes from. And the special thing about fermentation is that, you know, because, you know, food production sort of disappeared from the fabric of our communities in the United States, you know, really such a very long time ago now. But that coincided with the rise of what I would describe as the war on bacteria, and this idea that, you know, bacteria are so dangerous, and the only good bacteria are dead bacteria. And so, you know, for a food that is just as, you know, utterly simple to make as sauerkraut, an element of fear has been introduced. And I would say that, you know, the number one question that I encounter from people is in relation to sauerkraut. And the question is, you know, how can I be sure that I'm getting good bacteria growing rather than bad bacteria? And, you know, the answer to that question is because, you know, this is a strategy for safety. I mean, the number, according to the USDA, the number of documented cases of food poisoning that have been recorded from fermented vegetables in the United States is zero. Wow. There are very few foods you could say that about. You certainly couldn't say it about raw vegetables, because every year we hear about people getting sick from spinach, lettuce, tomatoes. It's right. One thing after another. You know, incidental contamination is always a possibility. We just live with that possibility. But if we were to take vegetables that had been subjected to some sort of incidental contamination, chop them up, salt them, and get them fermenting under their own liquids in the sauerkraut method, you know, basically it wouldn't matter, because the, you know, sort of powerful indigenous community of lactic acid bacteria that's there and that will always dominate over incidental contaminants will acidify the environment to such a degree that contaminating bacteria couldn't survive. And this is why, you know, fermentation has just been a strategy for safety, as well as a strategy for preservation. But I think part of the interest is because people have been so afraid.
And it's funny, because I spend some time, quite a bit of time in Europe, and we think of this war on bacteria, I should say, or war on fermentation as uniquely American. But even there, in some of the traditional communities, you know, with the regulations of the EU and cross-border trade in commerce, that there is a sense, you know, that things need to be more sterile in order to be safer, not less, to allow the sort of natural fauna work. How is there a way to fight that war, do you think? What, besides making, you know, sharing sauerkraut in a free school in Brooklyn?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think in you know, in our sort of, you know, regulation of the food industry, you know, we have to, you know, I mean, this general idea that we have underlying you know, food production regulations in the United States is that, you know, food should not sit out, you know, between 40 and 140 degrees Fahrenheit for more than 4 hours. I mean, this might be a reasonable general guideline for you know, a restaurant's everyday operations. But, you know, pretty much all fermented foods require, you know, that the food spend, you know, some hours, some days, some weeks, some months between 40 and 140 degrees Fahrenheit. And so, you know, we have to have sort of, you know, rational regulatory framework, you know, that not only, you know, recognizes and acknowledges that certain perfectly safe traditional foods, you know, sort of fall outside of this sort of, you know, generic standards that we're creating, you know, and also that certain of the standards that might be appropriate to impose upon, you know, large scale producers, you know, it's not necessary or feasible to apply them to small scale producers. And we need to sort of, you know, leave some space in our regulatory framework for, you know, small scale cheesemakers, small scale sauerkraut makers. And, you know, in many cases, you know, these people are really feeling the squeeze of regulations that are really designed for production on a much larger scale.
Is there something that someone listening who loves a good sour pickle as much as you did could do, do you think? I mean, do you write your congressman? Do you
well, I mean, you know, certainly it's entirely possible. And people, you know, all over the United States and beyond have started small vegetable fermentation businesses. But what I hear consistently from them is that, they have to educate their inspectors. That the inspectors sort of come into something like this, sort of presuming that there's something wrong with leaving cabbage sitting, above 40 degrees for a month or longer. And so sometimes people have to, sort of go on a long educational journey with their inspectors and, convince them that, well, really this is very safe and really we're allowing stores in our city, in our state to sell this product made in other places. And they're doing the same thing, leaving it out at above 40 degree temperatures. Right.
So let's talk about specific items in this journey that you've been on for many years. And what have things surprised you? What are some of your personal favorite fermented foods, or perhaps surprising? What do you like? What do you suggest people seek?
I'll tell you something that's really become a staple in my life that I love are sourdough pancakes. And I don't mean like pancakes that are a vehicle for maple syrup. I do like savory pancakes. Uh-huh. So and it sort of enables me to refresh my sourdough and keep it really vigorous and healthy without making bread all the time. So I start with a little bit of sourdough, add more flour and water, usually crack an egg into it. Then maybe I'll grate a radish or a turnip or, some other root vegetable. Then maybe I'll saute some onions and celery. If I have any leftover grains from the night before, maybe I'll add that to it. And I'll always put a little cheese into it. Huh. And then I make pancakes like that. Wow. So, it's relatively simple, but it's sort of like a different twist on a classic ferment. I've certainly experimented with all sorts of, exotic ferments from different parts of the world. I love this Filipino ferment that is shrimp and rice fermented together, balo balo.
Wow.
You ferment it for about a week or 10 days, and then you cook it again. It ends up having this quality of like a cheesy fish risotto or something like that.
Wow. Okay.
Really great. Lovely. I've experimented a lot with all sorts of variations on fermenting vegetables. You can ferment any vegetable. You don't have to stick with cabbage. That's not to say that every vegetable will ferment equally wonderfully. I definitely encourage people to experiment in small batches. A student of mine showed up at a class the other week with a vanilla bean mustard seed sauerkraut. It was a radically different kind of seasoning than I have ever had in sauerkraut. But it's a beautiful thing to see people taking these, sort of ancient processes and then just, giving them entirely new twists just by, adding something as simple as vanilla to it.
Fantastic. And I guess lastly, if people listening who may not be super foodies or cooks or DIY in revivalists or whatever, what do you think would be a good thing for someone to do just to understand the allure of this process?
Well, any fermented food that you enjoy eating, it is possible to learn how to do. Like, none of this is rocket science. These are all ancient rituals that our ancestors figured out millennia ago, and you could do any one you're interested in. The one I always recommend as a starter project is fermenting vegetables, making sauerkraut or kimchi. It's just, you don't need any special equipment. You can do it in a jar that's already there in your kitchen. You don't need any special starter cultures. It's all on the vegetables. You're not taking any risks. This is really intrinsically safe. You don't have to wait for months for it to be ready. You can start tasting it after a few days. With most ferments, there's no objective answer. How long is it ready? That's subjective. So, you just taste it every few days and gauge the flavor and just get a sense of the trending flavors and figure out what the spectrum of possible flavors are and where along that spectrum you like it.
Fantastic. Everyone should right now look in their fridge or maybe buy something fresh and start this process. Thank you so much, Sander, for being here. I remind people that you're going to tonight, if you'd like more of him, you will be at the Museum of Natural History for a talk about the art of fermentation along with Dan Felder, who's the head of the research and development department at Momofuku's Culinary Lab, and also Eleanor Sterling, who is from the Museum Center of Biodiversity and Conservation. That's at 6:30 tonight at the American Museum of Natural History. Good luck with the Beard Award nomination. I hope that you win on May 3rd here in New York. Thanks for coming out to Bushwick.
Thank you so much. Let me mention my website, wildfermentation.com. If people, you know, want more information about making sauerkraut or any other fermentation topic, I've got lots of information there. It's a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Thanks for being here. Go out there and buy The Art of Fermentation. Next week, we'll be talking with Isabella Wojcik. We'll be hosting, actually, and my colleague at the Beard Foundation. And she'll be talking with Emily Lucchetti, who is a James Beard Award-winning pastry chef, but also the chair of the Board of Trustees of the Foundation. And it'll be a show all about the Beard Awards. You'll learn what's involved, who's nominated, what the nominees say about the trends of food in America. Thanks for listening. This is Mitchell Davis of Taste Matters. By the time you tune in next week, I hope that you have had some delicious umami-rich fermented product that you made yourself.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website, or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.